And a very good morning to you. It's John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group back with you for another program of The Law and You. This is your opportunity to get free legal advice between now and 9.30. That's 10.30 Queensland Tweed Heads time or Tweed Coast time, daylight saving time, whatever you want to call it. All you need to do, get on that telephone as soon as you can. 55208888 is the number. That's 55208888. If you live south of the Tweed River, of course, you need to put 07 in front of the number. And you can always use our email address, talkback@4crb.com. If you're wanting to send us a question, which we would be able to answer next week. And just a reminder too that if you miss the program, or alternatively, if there's something discussed that you want to have another listen to, you can always go to the Bell Legal Group website. That's www.belllegalgroup.com.au. And you'll find that the program from the previous week will be there as an audio, and there's also dot points in relation to what was discussed. But the program is all about your calls, and that's what we need right now, 55208888, and you could be our very first caller for today if you get on that telephone right now. But while we're waiting for some calls to come through, one thing that is going to come into effect in Queensland before we know it, and is the substantial changes to the guardianship legislation. So there's the Guardianship and Administration and Other Legislation Amendment Act, which will take effect on and from the 30th of November this year. And it will impact the Guardianship and Administration Act 2000, the Powers of Attorney Act 1998, and the Public Guardian Act of 2014. Now, probably one of the most important thing about these changes is that they will introduce new forms for the enduring power of attorney, as well as the Advanced Health Directive. So whilst the old forms will remain online and be able to be used until the 30th of November, come the 30th of November, if you're going to make a power of attorney or an Advanced Health Directive, you must use the new form. And where people are going to have to be very careful is if they instruct their solicitor in the lead up to 30 November, but don't sign the documents until after 30 November. If it's done in the old form, it will be ineffective. So you need to make sure that if you're making a power of attorney now, you have it completed prior to 30 November 2020. But enough of that. We've got callers coming in, and we'll say a very good morning to Eugene. G'day, Eugene. How are you today? Eugene, are you there? Hello, Eugene, are you there?
Yes.
Hello, yes. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good, thank you.
That's good. How can we help?
Yeah, I'm going to court this Friday against somebody. He owes me $22,000.
Sorry, how much does he owe you?
$22,000.
Right.
I've had a QCAT judgment against him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's proceeded to go this far, and I sent the summons by mail a month ago. And I checked the post office. The letter wasn't accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the post office to retrieve the letter. Then I went to where he lives. He actually lives in a factory unit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a rooster, and I actually sold it to him. And I slipped it under the door.
Mm-hmm.
His car was out the front.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter was gone. I came back about an hour later and the letter was gone. Obviously, mm-hmm. he picked it up. It's a glass front door, so you know, I can see whether it's there or not. And now, the address I wrote on the envelope that I put on was my brother's address, because if he had seen my address, he would have rejected straight away.
Mm.
Anyway, it's gone in the mail and it's returned. I'm just picking it up now. And it said on it, not known at this address.
Oh, right. So he's picked it up from under the door. And then he's returned it, not known at this address.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Right, well, so what's your concern, Eugene, about what's going to happen on Friday?
Well, on Friday, what will happen? Will I still get the judgment against him?
But didn't you say you already have a QCAT judgment?
Yeah, I have, yes.
So what are you...
I'm going to Magistrates Court to enforce it.
Yeah, so what you're basically doing now is going to enforcement rather than judgment. So you've already got the judgment. And what's the what's the summons for that's returnable on Friday? Is that for him to appear before the Magistrates Court for an oral examination, or what's it for?
Yeah, it's for that to...
An oral examination. Right. Okay, well, I think what you need to do then is you need to do an affidavit of the lengths that you've gone to serve the document on him and depose to all of the facts that you've outlined, and in particular the fact that you slid the envelope under the glass door at the factory and that you went back a short time later whenever you went back and you saw that it was gone. And that you've since received it back in the mail saying not known at this address. And I think you need to depose to the fact that you know that he was there, his car was there, et cetera. And hopefully...
I've spoken to his neighbour and he said, he's right there now. Mm. I said, well, I won't disturb him just now, I'll come back later.
Yep, well, I would put all that in the affidavit. I mean, technically, that's what we call hearsay. But I would still put that all in the affidavit. I mean, if it was possible to get an affidavit from the next door neighbour who says that he was there, that'd be great. But if not, still just put it in your affidavit. The magistrate might... not take notice of it. But what hopefully will happen as a result of that is that the court will say, well, look, we regard service as the requirements for service as being sufficiently complied with. And the court very well may then make an order that he attend court. So I would just make sure you do a comprehensive affidavit of the lengths you've gone for service. Unfortunately, Eugene, quite often the court will bend over backwards to ensure that the defendant has been served. So be prepared for the possibility that they may say that you need to go to more lengths to serve him. One of the ways that the court has in the past held that service can be effected is either by email or even on Facebook. So, just if for any reason the court says, no, look, you've got to make better attempts to serve him, then you should inquire of the magistrate about options for service by Facebook or by email.
I have emailed him as well, the documents previously.
Right, okay, we'll put that in your affidavit as well.
And it wasn't returned, so no. Accepted it.
Yep, all right. So, so as long as if you can show that it wasn't rejected, you probably... Does your computer give you a read receipt to say that the email was read?
It didn't, but I can do it.
See whether you can get a read receipt, because if you can do that, that would obviously be very helpful as well. All right, then.
Okay.
Best of luck with that, Eugene. I sympathise with you. I know how difficult that system is.
Oh, I appreciate your help. It's been really good. Thank you very much.
All the best.
And thanks, CRB.
No trouble. And the time on 4CRB rolls along, 13 minutes past 9 past 10 on the Tweed, and we say a very good morning to Ron. G'day, Ron. How are you today?
I'm great, John. Yourself?
Well, indeed. How can I help you today?
John, I want to talk a little bit about trust. You hear so many terrible stories of family trusts being infiltrated when they really shouldn't be. Are there any trusts that are set up so spitters can't get at it, no matter what?
What do you mean by infiltrated, Ron?
They access. They take the matter to court, get access to the trust.
Who?
Or, well, people that are named in the trust. But
beneficiaries.
Beneficiary, but not yet.
Right, okay. Well, it obviously depends on the terms of the trust, but if you set up a discretionary trust, so an inter vivos, which means during your lifetime you set up an inter vivos trust, then obviously the terms of the trust dictate who is and who is not entitled. And so issues of who are the primary beneficiaries, secondary beneficiaries, tertiary beneficiaries, of course, come in. And the mere fact that someone is named as a beneficiary in a trust unless there is something in the terms of the trust that otherwise dictate, certainly does not give them any entitlement to any assets of the trust, because as the name suggests, it is in fact a discretionary trust and it's at the discretion of the trustees.
Okay.
So all the trustees need to be able to show is that they considered all beneficiaries in making their decision as to how they were going to apply the income or the assets of the trust. They don't need to give reasons. They just simply need to depose to the fact that they have considered all beneficiaries before making their decision. So my experience with discretionary trusts has been that they stand up pretty well. There is also, of course, testamentary discretionary trusts, which are established under will. They can be a little more problematic because, for example, if you have a discretionary testamentary discretionary trust under which there is effectively only one beneficiary, so say, for example, you've set up a testamentary discretionary trust which names a child as beneficiary because you're worried about them, about whether they're a spendthrift or not, so you want to make sure they don't dissipate their inheritance, and you have some residuary beneficiaries in there who, for example, might be charities where the funds that ultimately go on the death of the child or if the child fails to survive. That can be a little bit of a problem because someone can bring a challenge to that on the grounds that there has not been adequate provision made for them under the will, if they're, for example, the only child, or alternatively, that the circumstances under which the testator made their decision to put their share of the estate into a testamentary trust rather than giving it to them outright was not justified. So under the Succession Act, and in particular the family provision sections of that act, that might be a possibility of someone challenging.
John, is there such a thing as a bloodline trust?
Yes,
there
is.
What is it?
A bloodline trust is basically a trust which provides that the beneficiaries of the trust can only be people in the bloodline of the, and that's probably most common in a will. So a testator makes a will which provides that the only beneficiaries of the trust can be the biological children of the testator or the biological children of their children, so it continues down the bloodline. Sometimes people will include in that a provision that that the reference to biological children or to children includes biological and adopted children, but excludes stepchildren, for example. So those options are all open, Ron, in the preparation of a trust to make sure that it ends up where you want it to go.
You've got to get good advice, don't you?
That's exactly the thing, Ron. So whether it be preparing a testament, a discretionary trust during your lifetime, what we refer to in the industry as a, or in the profession as an inter vivos trust, or whether you're doing a testamentary discretionary trust, you need to get appropriate legal advice to make sure it's set up correctly, because there are a lot of issues in that. I mean, another example is that if you set a trust up under which, for example, your son is the trustee, your son is the primary beneficiary, and your son is the appointor of the trust, well, you might as well not set the trust up, because that could be challenged either in the family court or by creditors to say that the trust is nothing more than the alter ego of your son and therefore it's of no effect. So there are a number of dangers in setting up trusts or a number of things that you need to be aware of to make sure that they're done correctly.
Oh, look, thanks very much for your advice there.
Okay, Ron.
I hope it helps other people too.
I do too. Thanks for the call.
All the best.
And the time on 4CRB just continues rolling along. It's actually 19 minutes past 9. That's 19 minutes past 10 south of the Tweed. or across the border, as we say. If you've got a question or a query, the lines are presently open and there's no callers online. 55208888 is the number. That number again, 55208888. Now, I was talking earlier about the changes that are going to take effect from the 30th of November in relation to the new form of enduring power of attorney and the new form of advanced health directive. Now, one of the questions that obviously comes up in relation to such a change is, well, if I've already made a power of attorney, will the introduction of this legislation require me to make either a new power of attorney or a new advanced health directive? And the good news is that if the power of attorney has been properly set up and constituted prior to 30 November, and or the Advanced Health Directive has been properly set up and constituted prior to 30 November, then there is no need to make any change. Now, the only exception to that is that if you made an Advanced Health Directive prior to the 30th of November and included as an attorney, in that Advanced Health Directive is a person who is a service provider at a residential service where you are a resident, then come 30 November, the appointment of that service provider or service provider will no longer be effective. So if you're in that situation where you've appointed a service provider at the residential care facility where you live as a resident, as one of your attorneys, you will need to redo the documents. But enough of that. More callers online. As we say, a very good morning to Graham. G'day, Graham. How are you today?
Yeah, fine, thank you.
How can I help?
I have an enduring power of attorney, which I have three people that are assigned to it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people on there I've had a falling out with, and I no longer feel that they can act in my interest. So I'm just wondering, do I need to get a new power of attorney drawn up, or can I have the existing one amended to remove that person?
No, look, unfortunately, Graham, you'll have to do a new power of attorney because you can't simply amend a power of attorney. The way it's amended is actually by doing a new one. The other thing that would be important to do too would be to advise that attorney, and probably the best way to do that would be by doing a revocation document and provide notice to them that they've been removed as a power of attorney, but as an attorney for you. But you could discuss all that with your lawyer when you prepare the new document.
Excellent. Okay, thanks very much, Peter.
Okay, no trouble at all. And the time just keeps rolling along. It's 22 minutes past 9 past 10. South of the border, as we say, good morning to Dorothy. G'day, Dorothy. How are you today? Dorothy, are you there? Hello, Dorothy. No, we seem to have lost Dorothy, so we'll move on then to Anne. Good morning, Anne. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
That's good. How can we help you today?
I was wanting to leave the money I have to medical research, but if I do that and they get it when I've passed, they have to pay, as I understand it, they have to pay death duty on it. Is there anything that I could do or set up so that they would be entitled to my money for medical research without them having to pay death duty?
Right. Well, firstly, Anne, the good news is that there are no longer death duties in Australia. So the money would not be subject to death duties. If you have money coming out of your superannuation and that's going to your and that's going
no,
to go
it's purely assets. It's
okay.
Purely assets.
All right. Okay. So if the will provides that your assets are to be sold up on your passing and then transferred to the charity, then there's no problem with that at all. And if they're a deductible gift recipient, you can just simply leave your estate to them. So there's not
okay,
a problem.
Okay, well, that eases my mind a lot more.
Yes. So, no, you certainly don't need to worry about that, Dorothy. So that's one of the good things in terms of leaving assets to charities or leaving bequests to charities, and I must commend you for doing that. It's always
so
lovely.
So medical research is considered a charity?
Well, it'll depend on the organisation you leave it to. So as long as you leave it to one that is a registered charitable organisation. So when you make your will, normally what you would do is you would specify a particular organisation that you want to receive your money. And you can even specify how you want the money applied. So you want it applied to a particular area of research or whatever. So what I would be doing if I was you, Anne, is I would be discussing it with your solicitor, and they would be able to make inquiries on your behalf purely over the internet, which is a very valuable tool in this area. Our office quite often uses the internet to look up organisations that clients wish to leave money to so that we can get the correct name and description of the organisation. We can check its charitable status to make sure that it is a deductible gift recipient. So a lot of the charities even have on their websites the wording that they suggest be used in the will. Now, it's not necessary to follow that wording if you want the money. Most of them will say that, I leave the money to, ABC for its general medical research purposes. But if you want to apply the money, for example, into research for macular degeneration or whatever, then you can in fact specify that in the bequest so that the money will be applied in the manner that you want it to be applied.
And it wouldn't be necessary to seek someone, a solicitor who specialises in this type of thing?
Look, I would certainly recommend that you see someone who's competent in the area, so someone who does wills, because, as I say, the wording of the bequest clause is important, and it's also important to make sure that the organisation is correctly specified, because if you put in the name of an organisation which is incorrect, then it can create difficulties down the track in identifying what the organisation actually was. So quite often organisations are known by a generic name, but it's not necessarily their correct legal name. And if there are two organisations operating in the same field and a generic name is used, then there can be confusion about who the bequest is meant to go to. So for that reason, I always think it very important that the clear legal name of the organisation is specified so that you know it's going where you want it to go.
And what happens if they change their name? Because some of them do from time to time.
Well, the good news is that that doesn't matter, because if the name of the organisation is changed, but it's quite obviously your will has a date on it, and so it's quite easy to look back at that date and say, well, on the 21st of October 2020, the XYZ medical research organisation was known as the ABC. Medical research organisation. So it's quite easy to identify them and ensure that the bequest is going to go to the correct person.
Good. Thank you very much for your help. Appreciated.
Okay, Anne. All the very best. And
thank you.
That's pretty well bringing us up to our time for today. So thank you for your calls. Dorothy, I'm sorry that we seem to have lost your call. I don't exactly know what happened there, but when we went to you, unfortunately, it was giving us an engage signal. So obviously something went wrong, but Dorothy, please feel free to call back next week with your question, or alternatively, if you have access to a computer, you can always email us the question at talkback, that's one word, at 4CRB with the figure 4CRB.com. So you'd be able to do that. And don't forget, if you wish to listen to any of what we've broadcast today, in a day or two, that'll be up on the Bell Legal Group website, where you can go and listen to it if you want to pick up some of the information that we've talked about today. I'm John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group. It's been great to be with you today for a program of The Law and You. I look forward to being back with you again next Tuesday morning. But as always, until then, it's goodbye and God bless.